Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. It's a story of glamour and scandal and political intrigue and a battle for the soul of a nation. Hollywood Exiles from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
It's no secret that things can get heated in professional kitchens when it comes to the intense art of cooking. The James Beard Awards celebrate the best in food, and this year they took into account the past behaviors of the chefs who were nominated. Today on the show, you'll hear all about that spicy move. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for El Amin Abdul Mahmoud. This is Commotion. All right, they're called the Oscars of the food world. The James Beard Awards recognize the year's best chefs, cookbooks, restaurants all across the U.S. The 2023 ceremony took place last night. You'll hear about some of the big winners and also about a report from the New York Times that cast a bit of a shadow over this year's awards. It's about an anonymous tip line, which we'll get into. Ivy Knight is a Toronto-based food journalist, and Grace Onasanya is a line cook. They are both here in studio. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Welcome. So, Ivy, as I mentioned, Oscars of the food world. What does that mean? How big of a deal are the James Beard Awards?
The James Beard Awards are the biggest deal in the food world, definitely. They legitimize a chef, a restaurant, a cookbook like nothing else. I don't think there's anything that compares. You know, World's 50 Best has its place, but it's not the Beards.
Right. So this is epic. This is big. And just like the Oscars, Grace, the James Beard Awards have had a so white problem over the years.
Yes.
Things came to a head in 2020. Can you talk a bit about what happened there?
Well, just briefly, the 2020 awards were canceled, much like other award shows and gala events that year canceled due to the pandemic. And the James Beard Foundation released a statement that, you know, given the troubles that the hospitality industry is having in 2020 because we were hit really hard, we're not going to do the awards. And, you know, it doesn't seem right to also take into consideration the people in 2021, given what happened in 2020. So we're not having the awards then either. And a lot of people were like, okay, that makes sense. You know, a lot of things are shutting down because of the pandemic. Sure. But then less than a week later, it came out that the real reason why the awards were canceled was because not any of the 20 plus winners were a person of color.
Oh boy.
So the optics of that, you know, whether the winners are deserving or not, are really, really bad. So they decided instead of dealing with the fallout from that, they were just going to cancel the awards altogether. Unfortunately, it still came out that that's the reason why the awards were canceled. And here we are with another controversy.
Here we are. Okay. So after this happens, as you said, the foundation ends up pausing the awards for 2 years. And they also do an audit to, quote, remove any systemic bias. Ivy, what were some of the goals that they committed to at that time?
Well, according to my notes, they plan to diversify the judging body to 45% people of color by 2022, 2023, and 50% after 2023. The audit also recommended entrants provide a statement of alignment with the Beard's missions and prove adherence to its code of ethics. And it seems like they've sort of enacted this like secret police KGB style method of doing that. I don't really know. But the New York Times piece blew that open.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get into that. This is really interesting. There's a ton to unpack. Sticking with the racial diversity issue for just another minute, the awards were actually announced just last night. And the list of winners is made up of people from more diverse racial backgrounds than in past years. A lot of them use their acceptance speeches to reflect on what that means in the context of the food world. So let's have a listen.
You know, first of all, I want to thank me. I'm just kidding. All the gatekeepers who upheld the industry standard and did their bidding for systemic racism by telling me and others like me there was no market for my book or room in the industry for me, or they couldn't represent me or publicly be affiliated with me. Thank you.
Okay, that was Chef Gregory Gourdet, Chef Justin Pichirungzi, and cookbook author Ileana Maisonnet, new James Beard Award winners. Grace, you had a particular reaction when we heard Taken Over a Family Restaurant, like that you just had a look on your face that was...
There are a lot of people, a lot of cooks that especially come from immigrant families, and their mother, their father, their parents, their family, they start come to, you know, Canada or the United States, and they start a restaurant as a family business. And then, you know, when the kid grows up, they may not necessarily want to go into cooking, but they end up coming back to help out in the family business. And it happens again and again and again. And that's how we get some of, you know, the best and most authentic restaurants. And I'm just so glad that that's still happening. And we're bringing these, you know, cuisines, these ethnic cuisines, and we're bringing them forward into the future. Family restaurants and family businesses are just so important. So I really am happy to see a person who comes from that getting this award.
Yeah. And massively skilled when somebody has like a deep and inherited history of making food that has been passed down from generations.
Exactly.
Like you can't learn that in a school. You could go to all the French cooking schools in the world that you want, but
it really does come from experience. Yes.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So what else does hearing all those speeches make you think of in terms of what we're talking about and sort of opening up the frame to celebrate people who deserve to be celebrated?
I love that now we are focusing on the diversity. It's not just, you know, French cuisine that's highlighted. It's not just, you know, your American standards that are highlighted. And yes, the American cuisine is still a very big part of the James Beard, but we're getting, you know, Southern cuisine highlighted, Indigenous cuisine highlighted. We're getting more Asian cuisines highlighted. And that is just great, like to see, as, you know, a person whose parents emigrated to Canada, just see other cultures celebrated, representation matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Amen. Ivy, any winners from last night that you want to highlight?
Can I talk about some of my favorite nominees?
Oh, sure. Go for it. Let's hear about a couple of them. Yeah.
Raina and Sugar were there from Dallas. They own Sandwich Hag. And I was so happy to see them there. Amanda Cohen, who is a Toronto girl, Canadian, who is owning it at Dirt Candy in New York City. I was so happy to see her nominated. And Shana Lowe Banian from Cafe Mutton in the Hudson Valley. So those are all the nominees that I had like left my money with the bookies on. But also on Saturday night, seeing Ileana win, she was the last person who spoke in the clip.
The author, cookbook author, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
So to see her win and to know her story, that in 2017 she was given a column with the San Francisco Chronicle. She was the first Puerto Rican columnist in American history. Despite having that platform, she could not find a publisher or an agent for her book for 6 years.
Wow.
And she finally did. She finally, because of 2020 and what Grace was talking about, a lot of things changed in 2020. She finally got a publisher, and there she is winning the award for her cookbook at the Beards, and that was incredible.
Yeah, it's a big year for Puerto Ricans at the James Beards. We also had the chef from Puerto Rico actually won Best Chef South. Natalia Vallejo won Best Chef South, and she's Puerto Rican and highlighting Puerto Rican cuisine, so I'm really glad for them as well.
Mm-hmm. Love it. If you're just tuning in, I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud. You are listening to Commotion. We have Ivy Knight and Grace Onasanya here to talk about last night's James Beard Awards. So let's get into it. Grace, we know we've talked about some of the troubles that the James Beard Awards have had over the years. The most recent drama, as we've been alluding to, is about this anonymous tip line that was reported by the New York Times and was set up to investigate and potentially disqualify problematic nominees. The Times spoke with Sam Four. This is a chef who runs a pop-up in Texas. Yep. She was a finalist for Best Chef Southeast. And then one day she finds herself on a Zoom call and she's being confronted by private investigators from the James Beard Foundation. What happened there, Grace?
Well, from what I've read and seen online, this great article in the Times about Sam Four and Tuk Tuk Kitchen, she was, you know, confronted on this Zoom call by investigators in regards to ethics violations. Because as we said earlier, now finalists and nominees have to sign something that said they adhere to the James Beard Association Code of Ethics. So she found herself on this Zoom call defending herself from these accusations of harassment and bullying. And it turns out, from what I've read, that the social media post that they're referring to as harassment and bullying was her standing up against domestic violence, which, again, doesn't really track for me. I would think standing against domestic violence would be a good thing, not harassment or bullying, but, you know, what do I know? And there were some public and private kind of vague posts that didn't really mention anyone by name that were also considered harassment and bullying. Now, the lack of transparency in how these things violate the code of ethics is not very clear to me and not very clear to anyone else, which, again, comes back to the lack of transparency in this ethics investigation for the James Beards. It's all a very sticky situation.
Yeah, definitely. We also have the Times reporters Brett Anderson and Julia Moskin talking with a chef called Timothy Hansas, who brought his lawyer to the interview. This is always a good start. Mm-hmm. Timothy was nominated for Best Chef South, but was disqualified for accusations of yelling at customers and employees. That being said, his name was announced last night along with other nominees. Ivy, what's going on there?
I don't know. I feel like they want to have their cake and eat it too.
That's a good way of putting
it. You know, like with Sam and also with Timothy, it feels like they wanted the representation on the list. But I believe they said if they were disqualified, that even if they won by votes, the award would go to the second place winner.
Something like
that. But they would still get to have the name, the diversity possibly that the name represented without actually giving the award. It just seems like, insert swear word. it doesn't seem trustworthy. And here's the thing. If you want to find out what chefs are up to and if they're somebody you shouldn't be awarding, you know, like maybe don't give Mario Batali 5 James Beard Awards. Maybe don't give David Chang or Dan Barber or John Besh so many James Beard Awards. Maybe diversify a bit. But also, if you want to know if they're bad, talk to their staff. It's really simple. Talk to their staff for present, future, present, and past.
Yeah. Grace, what do you think about that as a line cook?
That is very apt. Like, one of the things with Sam Four that she discussed, like, she didn't know, like, the accusations against her were anonymous. Mm-hmm. So there was no way to defend herself against the detractors. And how do you know that this isn't some person with malicious intent, some cook that wanted to work at your restaurant that you didn't hire for whatever reason, some, you know, ex, you know, partner that wants to get back at you for some reason and demolish your career? Yeah. There's no way of knowing because it's completely anonymous.
Oof, we are running out of time here, and this is so interesting. I just want to know quickly from you both, do the James Beard Awards need to reform to stay relevant, or is it too late, just like in 30 seconds? Ivy, maybe you first.
I think that it's great that the James Beard Awards are actually doing something. It's better than the world's 50 best, who continue to be man for man organization until the end of time. So they're trying to do something. I mean, do better, but it's a good start.
Grace?
They're definitely taking steps, I believe. It would be nice if they could get through a couple of years without having another controversy, because as it stands, there's, you know, one after another, and that does not bode well for the award itself as an institution.
Fair enough. Thank you both for such an interesting conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, Grace Onasanya is a line cook at Quetzal in Toronto. Did I say that right, Quetzal?
Yes.
Okay, cool. And Ivy Knight is a food journalist who has written for The New Yorker, New York Times, Rolling Stone, and many other publications. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Jessie Cruikshank.
Jessie Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
Thank you.
I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud. You're listening to Commotion. I love theater. I used to work in theater, seen a whole lot of it. And I got to say, I've never heard of anything quite like a new show called No Save Points. You've got the performer Sebastian Heinz standing up on stage. He has electronic receivers all over his body. And there you are in the audience holding a controller to send signals to those receivers on his body and direct his movements as if he's a character in a video game, except he's actually a live actor in a play. Sebastian not only stars in the show, he created it too, based on his long love of gaming and the really profound experience he's had with his mom, who was diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease called Huntington's. Sebastian is with me now. Welcome.
Oh, it's so good to be here, Talia. Thank you so much for talking.
I'm so glad to have you. So I want to rewind and talk about where this all started for you as a kid. When did you first imagine yourself as a character in a video game?
Oh my gosh. I mean, definitely the playground. As very macho little kids, we would throw balls at each other and pretend that they were Pokemon balls. And then when they hit you, you'd have to pretend to be a Charmander or a Charizard or something, you know, like really silly, cool kid stuff. And then after a bit of time, I played some great PlayStation games, and I loved the animation of the characters, Jack and Daxter, Ratchet and Clank. I just loved how they move. They had these beautiful animations. And I started to kind of like look in the mirror and go like, what if I sort of went like this? I kind of look like a video game character right now.
What you're doing say that is you're sort of like, how would you describe the motion that you just made as you said that?
It's like for anybody who plays games, it's like an idle motion. It's almost like a puppet just breathing slowly.
You're sort of undulating your hands as you say it, almost exactly. As if you're like underwater a little bit is what I'm seeing. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Exactly.
Go on.
Mm-hmm. Over time, I love the way that these characters have these sort of canned animations. If you want them to do something, they like, you might press the A button and suddenly they jump and they stop and they crouch. Everything is so controlled. And that really lended towards my theatrical sensibilities. That sort of specificity of motion, call it.
Yeah. Tell me a bit more about that and why you wanted to bring that kind of motion up onto the stage.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I, in part, hadn't seen it before. Mm-hmm. I love to do things that I haven't experienced. I wanted to bring something that people recognize, right? Like people recognize, like, what? Like they recognize Mario jumping in the air. They recognize Boryuken, you know, from Street Fighter. They recognize these really, sort of iconic movements. And I wanted to find a way to merge like that pop culture with, my personal story.
Ah, cool. I'm gutted that people can't see you like I can right now, because even as you're talking, you have this way of moving where you're like fluid and then you stop, or you like, you look like you're in a freeze frame and then you come back to life. Like I can see how you're already bringing video games to life in your own physicality. So in this context up on stage, you relinquish control to the audience, right? They're holding mm-hmm. controllers and moving these sensors on your body. What's that like? Is that scary or is that attractive for you?
It is a combination of the two. It's scary in that I don't know what they're going to do. We have this one hacked Game Boy that works kind of like a remote control car, and it turns me into a remote control car. So if they press the A button, I jump. If they press the left button, I move left. If they press the right button, I move right. So I don't know what they're going to choose in any given moment. So that lends this real feeling of improvisation, not knowing what's going to happen next. But what's attractive is the feeling of engagement. You feel like they're watching, they see that they press a button and I react to it. Mm. Oh my God, this is like a human sort of toy video game that I can play with. And that's really bizarre and fun and interesting. My sense though is that because of the subject matter of the show, that I'm not just going to be a toy, that there's going to be a beating heart inside of that toy.
Right. There's an emotional core to the story that you're telling. Mm-hmm. And I understand that it has a lot to do with your mom. who's living with Huntington's disease. And one of the symptoms of that is that you're gradually losing control over your own bodily movements. I'm fascinated by this. How did doing this show help you understand and process her experience?
I mean, I look at my mother and I'm just, she'd be so embarrassed to hear me saying this, but, she's such an inspiration to me. She's such a strong, graceful, charming, wonderful person. And, I think in the first years of, after her diagnosis came to light, I had a really hard time seeing her behind what was happening to her body, and I just really focused on what was wrong. You know, I want to fix this. I want to change this. Something happened where I think maybe through working on the show, I got to think like, what is she actually thinking and feeling? And then I started to think like, who is she now? And I realized like, she's still 100% my mom. Like, she still makes me laugh. She still makes me cry. She's charming. She has an amazing smile. She dresses fabulously. She's a really wonderful old woman. And I feel like I kind of got her back in a way by thinking about her and creating a story about our story.
Amazing. And what were you hoping to convey by giving up control over your own body on stage?
Yeah, a bunch of things. So, you know, the show is it's a series of live action video games that the audience plays with this controller, right? A play you can play. And I wanted people to play around with these stories from our life. My mom and my story. So one of them is I'm a little prince and my mother is the queen. And the little prince has to go through the series of trials to survive and become a king eventually. And the audience gets to choose what his emotional reactions are going to be so that he can survive a wolf attack, for instance. Wow. Is he going to throw a stick at the wolf? Is he going to breathe calmly? And they're literally pressing the left and right button. And I'm switching between those different options live on stage. Huntington's affects your emotions deeply. It makes it very difficult to control your emotions. So we wanted to probe what would it be like to be trying to control your emotions, but knowing that there's something that is pushing you away from making the most obvious choice. Playing with control in that way.
Fascinating. And just briefly, like in the last few seconds we have here, when you look at the future of theater, where do you think we're headed when it comes to what you're doing, which is tech and audience interactivity?
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of really exciting artists working in this world. Milton Lim and Patrick Blencarn and Maddie Bautista and Brian Postalian, who are just like excited about gaming and theater coming together. I think as this generation who grew up on games is making more and more theater, you're going to see more and more interactivity because they're going to want to make what they grew up with into their, like, put it into their theatrical artistic language.
Wonderful.
So, yeah, I think more games.
Wonderful. More games on stage. We got to leave it there. Congrats on the show.
Thank you.
And thanks for being here. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Talia.
Absolutely. Sebastian Heinz acts in and created No Save Points. It opens today at Outside the March Theater in Toronto and runs until June 25th.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking.
That's a bit of Astrud Gilberto singing Girl from Ipanema. We wanted to play you some of that because we've just learned that the Brazilian singer has died at the age of 83. Get this, Astrud had no recording experience when she sang this song, which of course many people now think of as one of the defining songs of Brazilian culture. She didn't plan on singing it at all. She was married to guitarist João Gilberto in 1963. They took this trip to New York City for one of his recording sessions. He was supposed to record. The producer wanted someone to sing Girl from Ipanema in English. Astrud was the only one in the room who spoke English. So she got the part. They recorded with her. And it ends up becoming, of course, as you know, this huge hit that wins a Grammy Award for Song of the Year. It's such a gorgeous song. And if you get the chance today, I hope you can spend some more time with it. We remember Astrud Gilberto, who died at the age of 83. And that's it for the show today. That's it. That's the commotion. You can listen to any episode anytime, live or on demand. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for El Amin Abdul-Mahmoud.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.